Okay, let's begin with May the 23rd, 1926. And tonight we're going to have an absolutely wonderful, wonderful teaching on the unity of the divine will. And this first message on May the 23rd introduces us to that by telling us the power of even one act in the divine will. This is something absolutely incredible, and that we need to tell people who are beginning the journey in the divine will, we need to tell them rather quickly so that they will appreciate what journey they're actually becoming to participate in. So Louisa said, "I was accompanying my sweet Jesus in his sorrowful agony in the garden, especially when all the weight of our sins unloaded itself upon his most holy humanity, to the point of making him shed living blood. Oh, how I would have wanted to relieve him from the pain so excruciating. So while I sympathized with his whole being, he told me." Now we begin. "My daughter," he said, "my will," because his will is divine, "has the power to give death and to give life." Now, if you're studying the book of Revelation with me, you have seen in chapters 17, 18, 19 and 20 that the divine will can give death, because that is the final judgment, that some souls will be thrown into the lake of burning sulfur. It can give life, eternal life. And he's going to go on and emphasize the life here by telling us that if you die having made just one act in the divine will, it's going to have eternal consequences. So I want to give you a whole lot of scriptures, because there's a lot of scriptural background for everything we're doing tonight. One is John 14:6, "I am the way, the truth and the life." And I want to give you Psalm 59:16, Psalm 62:11, Psalm 63:2 and Psalm 66:7. And it's really good to look up the scriptures, because you will see that everything that the Lord teaches us in the divine will, he has taught step by step throughout the centuries, so that when in the end he would actually make the revelation, we would be ready for it. Just as our generation is actually ready for this, while what is being offered to us is astonishing, we accept it very easily. Generations before us couldn't have accepted it very easily. So he says, "My will has the power to give death and to give life. And since my humanity," now this is Jesus in the flesh, okay, "my humanity knew no other life but the life of the divine will." Now you could write a whole book on that. That means that while he was living in the flesh, everything totally, absolutely was divine will. The body was completely under the divine will. He gave the body no life of its own. Everything was divine will. "My humanity knew no other life but the life of the divine will. So, as the sins crowded over me," now we're talking about, in this section, we're talking about what I call the passion of Jesus during his hidden life. So, it didn't just happen in Gethsemane, it was happening for all of his life. So, specific to Gethsemane, he said, "as the sins crowded over me, my will made me feel a distinct death for each sin." Put very simply, the Lord has allowed himself to experience our hell that was due to us for any mortal sin that we've committed. "My will made me feel a distinct death for each sin." I've often said down the years, I've said it to priests, that I absolutely cannot grasp that they don't shiver when they say, "I absolve you from your sins." Because at that moment, Jesus is speaking. The priest can't absolve us. He can only give us what the Lord has actually prepared. But the sheer enormity of simply saying, "I absolve you," and the sheer enormity of a priest saying, "This is my body and this is my blood," I do not know how priests are not completely overcome by the enormity of the privilege and the responsibility that they have. So Jesus said he experienced a distinct death for each sin. That means that the agony is beyond anything we could imagine. "My humanity moaned under the pain of the real death." Now, the real death for sin is the second death, those of you who are in the book of Revelation know what I'm talking about. The second death is hell. I experienced a real death which my supreme will gave me. But over that very death which the divine will gave me, it made the new life of grace rise again for souls. So Jesus experienced within himself my death and resurrection from sin. So if you and I are living without sin, which you have to be if you're living in the divine will, if we are living without sin, he has paid for every single moment of that. And he has enabled me to rise from the death of sin to the life of grace. This is wonderful evangelization stuff. So as evil and bad as a creature might be, if the soul has the good fortune of letting one act of my will enter into herself, this is extremely important, put a VIP beside it. Even at the point of death, since my will is life, the divine will sows the seed of divine life in the soul, that the soul may be saved, because the power of my will be careful, so that this act of life, which is its own, which has entered into the soul, will not perish. Now, we've been told for many volumes before now that Jesus has repeated over and over and over again that what the divine will created, the divine will preserves. So if the divine will has allowed a soul to make one genuine act in the divine will, he will preserve that to eternal life. The enormity of that, I think, couldn't be measured. It's just astonishing. It will be careful so that this act of life of its own, which has entered into the soul, may not perish and turn into death. In fact, my will has the power to give death, as I have mentioned already from the book of Revelation, chapters 19, 20. But my will itself, now it can give death to something that is absolutely unworthy of it, okay? But my will itself and all of its acts are untouchable because they are divine. And they are not subject to any death. Now, I want you to underline that bit. The divine will acts, genuine divine will acts, are not subject to any death. That means that when the body has to lay down itself in the earth, the divine will acts in that soul go on into God's presence with the soul. They're not subject to any death. Now, if only one act of my will contains the seed of life, what will not be the good fortune of one who embraces within her own soul not one act only, but continuous acts in the divine will? In other words, if this is the reality for just one act in the divine will, what was it going to be like for those of us who are trying to live that way 24/7, 365? This creature receives not just the seed of life, but the fullness of life, and places her sanctity in safety. You really, really, really need to sit down with that and let it sink in. It's just incredible. So the continuous acts in the divine will puts your sanctity in safety. Now, in many of the volumes leading up to this, the Lord has been talking about putting the divine will in safety and putting the graces of redemption in safety and all the rest of it. And now he's telling us how to put your own sanctity in safety as well by doing these continuous acts in the divine will. One of the questions that people starting out in volume one ask is, you know, how many acts do you have to actually do? You know, I mean, is there a limit? And the point is, there isn't, because you're entering a divine will. So in the next paragraph, the time of redemption can be called Mary's time. And then in the following paragraph, then the time of the divine will is Louisa's time. We've had this before, and he's telling us again. Afterwards, Louisa said, my poor mind was wandering in the holy divine will, doing my usual acts in it. It seemed to me that everything was mine, because Jesus keeps on repeating the fact that when you become one with the divine will, what is his is yours and what yours is his. Seems to me everything was mine. And as I went around through all created things to impress everywhere with my I love you, my adoration, my glory to my creator, I acquired new knowledge of what God had done for the creature. Now, what she's saying here is, as you do your rounds, that is, if you really do them at the depth that they should be done, you will grow in knowledge and understanding. And she said, I acquired new knowledge of what God had done for the creature and of how he has shown his great love for us. Okay. Now, the supreme will seemed to delight in making known the new surprises of its love, so that I might follow its acts in order for it to give me the right to possess what has come out of its creative will. Now, you have to take this slowly. Here she is putting her I love you and glory to my creator on absolutely everything so that she can give adoration and praise and all the rest of it. And she's saying that the response of the divine will was to take delight in showing new surprises of his love so that Louisa could follow its acts. And in following its acts, that she would acquire the right to possess what had come out of the divine will. So notice none of this is automatic. This is entirely the relationship between you and the divine will and how you respond to the divine will and how he responds to you. So there's going to be saints in the divine will, great and small. My littleness wandered amid its immense goods. We'll talk about that in the next section. In the meantime, my sweet Jesus came out from within my interior. That means the kingdom of God is within, 1 Corinthians 3:16. And he told me, my daughter, when my queen mother came out to the light of day when she was born, everyone was turned towards her. And as though having one single gaze, all pupils looked to the one who was going to dry their tears by bringing them the life of the longed for Redeemer. So her position in history is completely unique and unrepeatable. She was going to dry the tears of the human race. And therefore, what he's saying here is that the combined longing of the human race for a savior, he's saying that was the gaze of the human race upon her. And of course, Paul tells us in Romans 8:19 that the whole of creation was longing for redemption. So Jesus is saying that was all centered on her. And all creation was centered on her, feeling honored to obey her wishes. The divinity itself was all for her and all intent on her in order to prepare her and to form her. Now, why would this be? It's because the entire solution to the human race was coming through her. The solution to the human race was the savior. And it had to be a divine person becoming man. So she had to be prepared. And so all of the seas of graces and everything were for the sake of making a correct tabernacle on the earth for him. That's what he's saying here. The divinity itself was all for her and all intent on her in order to prepare her and to form in her with surprising graces the space into which the eternal word would descend to take human flesh. Now, John says in John 1:14 that the word was made flesh and tabernacled among us. So Mary is that tabernacle or the Ark of the Covenant, whichever way you want to look at it. So there's God creating a space for him in a human being. Now, I want to solve a problem here that is in these texts all the time. It's the wrong use of the word virtue. Let's look at it now. If the virtue were not present within us, now in English, that doesn't make sense. That while we operate, deal with, or speak to one creature, we wouldn't neglect all the others. Now, if you look up the word virtue in a good dictionary, it comes from the word virtus in Latin, which means manliness or courage. Another use of the word in the English language is that it is the practice of moral excellence or righteousness. And the only way we can use this word in one of the ways that it's used in this book is we say something is by virtue of or by reason of. Okay. Therefore, the word virtue can't be applied to God at all. It's completely wrong. And this is why I have been continuously replacing the word virtue with power. Let's see. Now, I haven't seen the original text. So I don't know the actual word she used. It's just the translator used the word virtue and created problems for us. So let's try the word power. If the power were not present within us, that while we operate and deal with or speak to one creature, we do not neglect the others, all would have said to us, leave all of us aside, think only of the Virgin. Now it makes sense, because God has the power because he's omnipotent. He can do anything he likes. And he can be omnipresent. He can be present to everybody. So now if I change that word virtue to power, the whole thing makes sense theologically. And it makes sense in English language as well. Unfortunately, the word virtue is used in different ways, just to confuse you in this text. I don't mean this particular text, but in these volumes. So God is saying he's omnipotent, he can do anything. And that was said to our Blessed Mother as well at the time of the Annunciation. Nothing is impossible with God. In the Old Testament, the way the Lord used to say it to the people who are struggling, like Joshua, for example, when he was conquering the Promised Land, is the arm of the Lord too short? That means, does God's power have limits? And so God is omnipresent and he can do everything. So while he is dealing with one person, he's dealing with everybody else as well. Okay, and if you look at some of the meditations of the saints and the people who are called blessed by the church, meditating on the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem, one of the ones I love, and I think it comes from Dom Marmion, he said that the child who suckled his mother's breast was ruling the world. The child who needed to be wrapped in swaddling clothes was receiving souls after death and judging them. And so, you know, the saints had the ability to touch the eternal reality that was going on and not just get stuck on the material and the physical. So he's omnipotent. He can do anything. You notice in the resurrection of Jesus that Jesus could be in many places at the same time. So what Jesus is saying here is that if the human race were given a choice, they would have said, put all your attention upon this virgin because the solution is there. Now, I want to compare that with John 17, where Jesus is actually praying just before his death for his church. And he said to the Father, I pray for them, not for the world. Now, you'd say to yourself, but he came to save the world. Why is he not praying for the world? He's not praying for the world because all attention has to be given to his apostles. Because if the apostles get it right, the world will be okay. They will be looked after. If the virgin who must bring forth the Messiah, if she's okay, then the rest of the world will eventually be okay. So this is giving all the attention. Now, what we're doing is preparing for the Lord, saying to Louisa, this is why I have to give you all the attention. Because everybody coming after you is depending on you making it through. But that's actually where he's going with this. So the text then says, leave all of us aside and think of this virgin only. Centralize everything in her that she may let the one come in whom our hopes, that is the Redeemer, our life and all our good are placed. All our hopes for the future, all our prayers, all our sighs are for a Redeemer. And it's all going to come from her. So centralize everything in her and make sure that she has it. Now, we've already dealt with texts in which Jesus explained the centralizing of all redemption in the Virgin and centralizing all to do with the divine will in Louisa. Therefore, Jesus concludes, the time in which the Sovereign Queen came to the light of day can be called the time of Mary, the time of my mother, he said. And then he goes on immediately and said, this, my daughter, can be called your time. So we go on to Louisa's time, because he's using the same technique all the time to explain something to Louisa. He explains his mother's calling. To explain Louisa's office, he explains his mother's office. To explain the grace going into Louisa, he explains his mother, so that Louisa has something to compare with. So he says, right now, that's in the 20th century, all are turned towards you. I hear the voice of all as if they were one, praying to me, pressing me, that my will may acquire its absolute rights over you, so that acquiring its total dominion, it may pour into you all the fullness of the goods that the divine will had established to give if the creature had not withdrawn from my will. So Jesus is saying, just as God the Father heard the prayer of all the saints of the Old Testament, now Jesus is saying that God the Father has heard the prayer of all the saints of the New Testament and all of us in the divine will, praying for the kingdom of the divine will to come to pass. So he's heard all of our prayers. He has heard all the prayers of the future. Everything is present to him. That's going to be the message in the next message on May the 27th, that everything is centralized in him. He can hear everything. What we call past, present and future, it's all present to him. And he said, I listened to that prayer. Now, what he's saying is prayers that have not yet been prayed because they're still in the future, he has heard them. Our aching prayer that the divine will would come on the earth and rule on the earth, that's all been heard, he said. And the result of it is that he raised up Louisa so that he could open the door. It's a fascinating thought. So he said, the whole of heaven, our celestial mother, the angels and the saints, they're all turned towards you for the triumph of my will, because their glory in heaven will not be complete if my will does not have its complete triumph on the earth. So he's going to show us in the next text just how extremely important that is, that for the saints to experience the fullness of the heritage that they have been given in heaven, then the divine will must triumph on the earth. Okay, so the saints really want this badly. So do the angels. Everything was created, he said, and you need to put a VIP beside this. Everything was created for the total fulfillment of the divine will. And until heaven and earth return into this circle of the divine volition, they feel their works and their glory and their beatitude as only halved. Because not having found its complete fulfillment in the creation, the divine will cannot give what it has established to give, which is the fullness of its goods, of its effects, of its joys and happiness and everything that it contains. So those of you who have been with me for the book of Revelation have an advantage over the others, because when heaven and earth return into the circle of the divine will, you have the new heaven and the new earth. And that is Revelation 21 and 22. The new heaven and the new earth, when the whole of the earth, or at least most of the people on earth, will actually be in the divine will and God will actually be reigning on the earth. And this is the mystery that we're already living in today. So the reason why God wants the triumph of his divine will on earth is not because he wants to lord it over us. That's what human beings do, and that's what demons do, is lord it over other people. That's not it. He said, the reason for this is that the divine will wants to give the fullness of its goods. It wants to give the fullness of its effects, the fullness of its joys, and the fullness of the happiness that it contains. It wants to share itself completely with us, not by halves. This is why they are all longing. There's Romans 8:19 again. The whole of creation is longing for this recovery. My will itself is all for you and is all intent on you. The divine will holds nothing back of its graces and light, and whatever it takes. I love that expression. Now, I suggest you take that little expression up and say to the Lord at some point when you're having a sincere and deep communion with him, Lord, do whatever it takes to make out of me what you want. Do whatever it takes to bring me to the point where I can cooperate fully with your divine will and you can be truly, truly glorified in me. It's a very important clue that's given to us here. So he said to Louisa that I have to do whatever it takes to form in you the greatest of prodigies, which is the divine fulfillment and the total triumph of the divine will. Imagine the infinite, almighty, ever-living, everlasting, eternal deity giving that amount of attention to any creature, let alone us. It's unbelievable. Which one do you think is a greater prodigy? Watch this now. Louisa is being asked a question. This time she gets it right. that a little light remains enclosed in the sun, or that the sun remains enclosed in the little light. Now she gets this one. Oh, she said it would certainly be more prodigious if the little light enclosed the sun. You see, that's what he's aiming at trying to get us to understand. We're the little light enclosing the divine will in us. It's just, he's calling it the prodigy of prodigies, which it is. Indeed, she said, it seems impossible to me that this could happen. And Jesus immediately said, what is impossible for the creature is possible for God. That quotation is directly from Luke 18:27. But it's the same message as was given to our Blessed Mother in Luke 1:37. He said, the little light is the soul, and my will is the sun. We're going to go into this in a big way in the next message. My will is the sun. Now, my will must give so much to the little light. Now notice the must give and the so much to the little light so as to be able to make of it a circle and be enclosed in it. So he says, I have to make you a sun. I have to make you a circle. I have to create a bit of space inside of you if you're going to be this thing. He has to do everything. That's why he said a little bit further back, I'll do whatever it takes to accomplish this. Okay. So, my will must give so much to the little light so as to be able to make of it a circle. That's number one. And be enclosed in it. That's number two. And I would add a third one. And persevere. And since the nature of light is to spread its rays everywhere and remaining in triumph within the circle, the remaining is another prodigy, it will spread its divine rays to give the life of my will to all. So, okay, I become a sun, S-U-N. The divine will takes up its residence in me. We're going to call this a throne very shortly. And from this residence, he radiates out not only to the people all around you, but to the whole earth. He reigns, his new tabernacle. He's just using different language than the word tabernacle. So it spreads its rays everywhere while remaining in triumph within this circle. It will spread its divine rays to give the life of my will to all. A-double-L means from Adam to Zachary, past, present and future. This is the prodigy of prodigies, which the whole of heaven longs for, that the divine will would actually be enthroned in each one of us. Now, to be enthroned in each one of us means our total, complete, absolute surrender 24/7, 365, right up to and including our last breath. Therefore, he said, give broad field to my will. In other words, don't resist in anything. Let it happen. Oppose it in nothing so that what was established by God in the work of creation may have its fulfillment in and through you. Wonderful stuff. So now we're going to develop this in the next message, May the 27th. And this is a long message and I might have to go over the time a little bit to complete it. That is if I succeed in explaining it. So the first thing is an experience between Louisa and Jesus, which is normal. And Louisa responds and then Jesus explains. So we're going to start where they usually begin. I was doing my usual acts in the Supreme Volition, she said, and an inaccessible light enveloped my little being. Now, 1 Timothy 6:16 tells us that God dwells in inaccessible light. Entering into the divine will is entering into God. 1 John 1:5 tells us that God is light. In him there is no darkness. So she's entering into the actual presence of God. So it enveloped my whole being. It made as though present to me all the works of my Creator. Now, here she is and the divine presence is all over her. Of course, in him, she can see whatever he wants and allows. So she sees the works of her Creator I had an I love you for each created thing, emotion for each motion, an adoration and a thank you of gratitude for all creation. Now notice that she isn't lazy. She just doesn't sit there and enjoy. She actually works. Whatever she sees, she does her rounds of adoration and praise and thanksgiving. However, I understood that it was the light itself that administered to me that I love you for each thing, that motion, that adoration. I was just a prey to that light. While it enlarged me, it made me smaller and did whatever it wanted with my littleness. Now, she is in the actual presence of God, therefore she sees things clearly that she won't see outside of the presence of God. Number one, she said, I had an I love you for each created thing, a motion for each motion, a thank you, a gratitude, an adoration and all the rest of it. But then she realizes that John 15:5 is actually true. Without me, Jesus said, you can do nothing. And that Philippians 4:13 is also true. I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength. So it was the divine will that was actually enabling her to give this response. In other words, he's the prime mover. He's the prime actor. Therefore, these acts are divine. This is where we're going. The origin of the act tells you whether it's divine or human. If I simply lift up a pen and put it back down again, that's just a human act. It's all over, done with, there's no value, unless added value is given to it. These acts that we're talking about have their origin in God. They are divine in their origin and therefore the divine acts. She said, I was just a prey to that light. In other words, I was there, present, completely open, completely active, responding to the stimulus of grace that was given to me. And he could enlarge me or make me smaller, whatever he wanted to do with my littleness. Now, while I was in this state, she said, I was sorrowful. How you can be in the actual presence of God and be sorrowful is an entire mystery to me. But we have known in the 19 volumes we have studied that Louisa has a fixation on actually seeing Jesus in the flesh. And if she doesn't see him in the flesh, as far as she's concerned, she hasn't seen everything. It's totally fascinating. Here she is in the actual presence of God. And I was sorrowful because I couldn't see my sweet Jesus. And I thought to myself, Jesus has left me. Now she's in the actual presence of God. No wonder we need this revelation about the Holy Trinity that's coming up. Jesus has left me, she said. And in this blessed light, I don't know where to turn my steps in order to find him, because one can see neither where it begins nor where it ends, naturally, because it's eternal. And so the sheer immensity of God's presence is not something that we can comprehend at all. Oh, holy light, she said. She's submerged in inaccessible light. That's the first line, the second line. Okay, she's submerged in inaccessible light. And she says, oh, holy light, let me find the one who is my whole life, my highest good. Now, to me, that's like a fish in the ocean saying, oh, holy water, let me see something. When the water is its life. So, while I poured myself out because of the pain of the privation of Jesus, in the heart of God, she said, the pain of privation of Jesus. Now, that's her lack of understanding of what's actually happening to her. And very often, the problems we have in prayer are our lack of understanding of what's actually going on between us and God and what God is trying to say and do. And so we think we're having a problem in prayer when we're not having a problem in prayer. I always remember the story of a priest telling me, oh, many years ago, that he went to the bedside of a woman who was dying. And she said, oh, Father, I have a terrible problem and I'm dying. And he said, what's your problem? Thinking that he was going to hear a confession, you know, and forgive her and then she'd die in peace. She said, Father, I can't pray. And he said, what do you mean you can't pray? He said, can't you say the Our Father? Well, no, she said, I can't. He said, "Have you forgotten the words?" And she said, "No, it's not like that." She said, "I say, 'Our Father,' and I can't get beyond that," she said. "Hours later, I'm still there." I said, "If I had your problem, I'd be happy." There she was in the depths of contemplation, and she didn't know. It took the priest's understanding of what was going on between her and God to bring peace to her soul. And Jesus is going to have to explain what's going on between Louisa and God to bring peace to her as well. She thinks she's having privation of Jesus. But Jesus is the second person of the Blessed Trinity. And if you're in the actual presence of God, he's there. So Jesus, all goodness, she said, "He came out from within my interior, and all tenderness," he said, "My daughter, why do you fear? I do not leave you. Rather, it is my supreme will that eclipses me within you." Now, what is eclipsed? The supreme will is this inaccessible light. And what is eclipsed in Jesus? It is his humanity, which Louisa is wanting to see. And so he explains to her that his humanity is less than his divinity. And therefore, if the divinity is actually manifest at this particular moment, the humanity is eclipsed, something smaller. So, "I do not leave you," that's the Joshua 1:5, "I don't ever leave you or desert you." Okay. "Rather," he said, "it is my supreme will that eclipses me," that is my humanity, "within you," that is in your soul. You don't see it in your own soul. The problem is actually inside of you, both your understanding and everything else. "The light of my will is endless. It is infinite." I want to give you Psalm 36, verse 9. "Lord, in your light, we see light." But notice that Louisa has brought her lack of understanding of what's happening into this experience, and therefore she has to be taught in the experience itself. So, "The light of my will is endless." It's infinite. "Its boundaries cannot be found, neither where it begins nor where it ends," because it doesn't have a beginning or an ending. It's infinite. "On the other hand," he said, "my humanity does have its boundaries. It does have its limits. And therefore, since my humanity is smaller than the eternal will, I remain enwrapped as though eclipsed within it. And while I am in you, I give the field of action to my will. I enjoy its divine operating in the littleness of your soul, and I prepare a new lesson for you," and so on. Now, I want to give you a couple of examples of where the scriptures prepare us for this thing about Jesus being eclipsed in light. God is light, and the divine will is light. And Jesus has just said, it's endless, there's neither beginning nor ending to it. So if you go back to the transfiguration in the Gospels, you are told that, first of all, you see I'm going to use the word heavy, humanity of Jesus, to simply emphasize the flesh, you know, the material side. You see that first at the beginning. And then as Jesus enters into prayer and goes into the depths of prayer, he is gradually transformed into light. So he goes deeper and deeper and deeper into the divine will. And therefore the light actually takes over. That was only a short experience because the apostles were there and they wouldn't cope with this at all. Secondly, in the resurrection, Jesus is so eclipsed in light that nobody can see him unless he does what he's doing to Louisa right now. He comes out of the light, comes down and lowers himself to a lower manifestation so that they could see him. And only certain people could see him because they had been prepared both by his evangelization and by their sufferings and his sufferings and so on. So Jesus therefore appeared and disappeared. This is what he's doing with Louisa all the time, but she doesn't really grasp it. Finally, in the Gospel, we're told that in the Ascension, Jesus was absorbed into the light of God. And therefore, he cannot be seen by us because we're down on this material dimension and we can't see this light. We can't see him. He's eclipsed. Okay. So when Louisa enters the divine will, she can no longer see the form of Jesus, the outline of him, because he is light. That is John 8:12 and John 9:4, I am the light. So in each case, at the transfiguration, the resurrection, the ascension, and when Louisa enters into the light, Jesus is present all the time because he's the second person of the Most Blessed Trinity. And St. Peter has a nice comment on this, but I didn't remember to mark it now. Just hold on a second. It's 1 Peter 1:8-9. Peter says to the early Christians, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with the inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Peter is saying the fact that you can't see him doesn't mean that you are deprived of anything. It's just that you cannot penetrate this inaccessible light. And this is what Jesus is trying to get through to Louisa right now. So Jesus is with her in this experience in entering into the divinity. She can't see him because she only sees the essence of God, which is God is light. So he says, my humanity is smaller than the eternal will, so I remain enwrapped and as though eclipsed within it. And while I am with you, I give the field of action to my will. So he lets the greater operate rather than the lesser. And so I enjoy its divine operating in the littleness of your soul. And I prepare a new lesson for you to make known to you more and more the wonders of my supreme will. And we're going into a big, big lesson now. Therefore, when you swim in the divine will, I want you to be certain that I am with you. To be certain, no more doubts. Even more, he said, I do what you do together with you. Now, the church has told us this all down the centuries, that all our prayers are through him, with him, and in him. Okay. But he's speaking specifically here, and we've dealt with this in many of the earlier volumes, that when we do genuine acts in the divine will, not only do we do what Jesus does, he does what we do. Now, in the next paragraph, he's going to start talking about the unity of the light of the divine will. And once he brings up this subject, the unity of the light of the divine will, he's going to use this terminology from here on in. So whatever he said before now, he's going to use this new terminology. So this is the new lesson he has prepared for her. Now, my daughter, you must know that the true light is not, translation says separable, we would say divisible. You can't divide it up. Separable doesn't actually give you the correct thing there. And then he gives an example of the sun in the sky. Look, he says, the sun which is in the sky above you also has the privilege or the prerogative and possesses the unity of ordinary light. We have to put the word ordinary there because we're going to be talking about the extraordinary reality of the divine light. The light is so compacted together. So we see the sun as a planet. Everything is compacted together, okay, within its sphere, so as not to lose one atom. Now, that's the point he's going to be making. It's not going to lose one atom, no matter what it does. And even though it descends down below, filling the whole earth with light, the rays of light never separate. You see, to use the expression, the light never separates, it's not English and it doesn't communicate anything. The rays of the light of the sun never separate. They don't divide up. And you can't pick up one of the rays in America and hold on to it. And we pick up another one in Europe and hold on to it. We can't do that. The rays never, ever separate from the sun. It is so compact within itself. It is so united. It is not divisible, that it never loses anything of its solar light. Now, he's beginning to move into explaining to us the one point, which is the singularity of God. He's beginning to explain it, and as usual, he uses the sun. So the sun is so compacted that it actually appears to us as a solid thing in the sky. The rays of light are never divided. They cannot be separated. Okay. No matter what light or heat or energy it gives to anything else, it loses nothing. Now, you see, we can't explain that because the scientists try to tell us that the solar flares, that it is sending out light and energy and all the rest of it. We'll stick with this. So much so that altogether it spreads its rays, dispelling everywhere the darkness from the earth. And altogether, now notice in each case, altogether, all the rays are together in a unit, operating in an indivisible manner. This is going to be extremely important when we go down to the next paragraph. So they operate all together. So in the daylight, all the rays are exposed to the earth and you get light and heat and energy and all the effects that it gives. And it withdraws the light at night. It withdraws everything. It leaves nothing. And that's the important thing. It withdraws its light, leaving not even the traces of its atoms. Now, if we go back to a point I've already made, now I don't want to stay here all night, but if we go back to a point I've already made, sending souls into the lake of sulfur is the divine light withdrawing from them. We just call it the lake of sulfur. That's an image that the Bible uses. They're in absolute terrifying darkness, because the divine light has withdrawn. Okay, so we get night on the earth when the daylight is actually withdrawn from us. It withdraws its light, leaving not even the traces of its atoms. Now, let me give you that in a different image. I've been talking about Jesus appearing and disappearing. The light of the sun appears in the morning and disappears in the evening. It gives us all its effects during the day, takes them away at night. And Jesus is describing it as operating as a single whole entity, totally compact. Now, he's giving us a very, very, very good introduction to the Blessed Trinity. Very good. If the light of the sun were divisible, he said, for how long would the sun have light to give you, having no more strength to illuminate the earth? In other words, the sun would have worn itself out long since. One could say, divided light, desolate earth. Now, the big problem is divided. Okay, so divided light, desolate earth, one compact unity of light, and you get all the goods that the sun can give you. So the sun can sing victory, and it possesses all its strength and its effects thanks to the unity of its light. Now, this is the expression that's being introduced. And this is the bit you have to remember. The unity of its light, it's operating all as one piece. And if the earth receives so many admirable and innumerable effects to the point that the sun can be called the life of the earth, everything comes from the unity of the light it possesses. It all comes from the fact that it operates as one compact unity, which after so many centuries has lost not even one atom. Okay, so if it was divided light, it would be losing all the time. But what the Lord is saying is that the sun has lost nothing. So it has lost not even one atom of light, which was entrusted to it by God. And therefore, it is always triumphant, always majestic, always fixed, and the scientists are trying to make out that it isn't. And it's always stable in its light, and that's something the modern scientists don't want to accept either. And it's always singing the praises of the triumph of the glory of the eternal light of its creator. Now, all of that's introduction. So in the next paragraph now, we're going into the unity and inseparability of the divine will, which is the centre of the Most Blessed Trinity. This is one of the central messages of the 36 volumes. If you don't get this, you don't get divine will. So put a VIP on this text. Now, my daughter, the sun is only a symbol of the eternal will. And if this symbol possesses the unity of light, much more so does my will, which is not a symbol, but is the reality. Okay, the sun is merely pointing to a reality that we find rather difficult to grasp. So while the sun can be called the budding of the inaccessible light. Now notice the inaccessible light, 1 Timothy 6:16 again. That is the most blessed Trinity. And the sun is only a budding of that, therefore an early manifestation or a very light or small or unimportant showing of what this other thing is. Okay. And you have seen the immensity of this inaccessible light. That's where we started this message with at the very beginning. You've seen it. And you've seen how one does not see a globe of light like the sun. Because if you see a globe of light, there's a beginning and an end to it. And if you look at a model of the universe, the sun is one of the smallest of the stars that's in the universe. It's actually very small. It's big to us. But it's small in terms of the universe. So you didn't see a globe because you saw something that was eternal. So you saw the vastness such that the human eye cannot arrive at seeing where it ends or where it begins because it's infinite. And from here on in, we're going to have Louisa talk quite a lot about this because once this is opened up to her, the Lord opens up the reality to her to let her experience it more and more. Yet all this endlessness of light is one single act of the eternal will. This is the great singularity. It has been mentioned many times up to now, but this is the first time that you get a detailed explanation of this, and therefore this entire text is completely vital for understanding all of Louisa's writings. So, when you look at the words that are in front of you, you're being told everything is in one act or one point. And yet, as far as Louisa or creatures are concerned, it's vast and inaccessible. It has no beginning and no ending. All you have to do is try and remember who we are in the universe, because our solar system is only a speck of a speck of a speck in the universe. So if the solar system, and that's not talking about planet Earth, which is so much smaller than that, if that's our size just in the created universe, it means that we have no concept at all of the greatness and the vastness of God. And yet God is one single, simple point. Everything is in there. Absolutely everything. So while it's utterly vast to us and it contains all the acts that God has done and accomplished from beginning to end, everything is in this one act. And when we enter into the divine will and do acts in the divine will, we are entering into this one act of God. Okay. Yet all the endlessness of light is one single act of the eternal will. All of this uncreated light. Now notice the uncreated. We're dealing with eternal stuff. All this uncreated light is so compacted together as to become inseparable and indivisible. One single point. And so, more than the sun, it possesses the eternal unity. Completely indivisible, this eternal unity. In which the triumph of God and all of our works is founded. Everything is founded in that unity. Can you see how hard we make it for God meeting with the chaos that is among humanity on earth? This triumph of the unity of the supreme will is the center of its dwelling place. It is the throne of God. It is the center of the Most Holy Trinity. Now, what I suggest is that you try and write this out. For the first time in my life, I actually wrote out what I was reading here. And it's really actually very impressive. Not what I wrote, but what I was trying to write from what is written here. It's really incredible. So on the one hand, you have the vastness of everything. And it's all contained in this one act. it's very difficult for us to grasp something that contains everything and is only just one act, and that this one, shall I say, entity is the very heart of the Most Holy Trinity and is the throne of God, this unity. So you see that unity for him is essential among us. And look at the disunity in the church. There are 30,000 sects of Christianity, for example. Look at the disunity among nations. Look at the disunity within nations. Look at the disunity within families. Look at the disunity within ourselves. You can see the enormity of the transformation that's got to happen to us if we've got to become like God. And so to come back into God's order, we've got to come back into that unity. And we've got to become part of that unity. From this divine centre, the most refulgent rays of light begin. That's where they start. And they invest the whole of heaven. Now watch this. This is really very interesting. So here you have the centre of the Most Holy Trinity. The rays of light come out from there, just as the rays of light come out from the sun during the day. Okay. And it invests the whole of the celestial fatherland. So all the saints and the angels are invested with the unity of the divine will. So that means that all the saints and the angels in heaven are completely part of this unity. And it explains why when the saints sometimes come to meet us and talk to us, that they talk like Jesus. And they respond like him, because they now are like him. That's what amazed me back, nearly 50 years ago, when St. Maximilian Kolbe visited me. I couldn't believe that it wasn't Jesus. He looked like him, he talked like him, he responded like him, and yet he told me he was different. It's very interesting. You see, the unity of the eternal Trinity invests all of them, and they all receive its innumerable effects. Now watch this. Abducting them into itself. So they're all taken into this unity, every one of them. So they're all now thinking the same, acting the same, wanting the same. So if you're praying for God's holy will to be done, all the saints are saying, yes, yes, yes. It makes of them one single unity with the supreme unity of my will. Okay, so all the saints and the angels become one with this reality. It's just amazing. So the divine rays going out from the throne of God actually draws them all into this reality of the unity of the supreme will. These rays invest the whole of creation and form its unity with the soul who lives in my will. So now he's coming down to us. Look, the unity of this light of my will, which resides in the centre of the three divine persons, is already fixed in you, he says to Louisa. In other words, the throne of God is already fixed in Louisa. Fixed means it has become stable, permanent. And we who are living in the divine will, what we want is that it will become fixed and permanent in us as well. So the light and the act are one. It's very bad English there. The light of God and the acts of God, they're one, whether they're in you or in him, because the throne of God is fixed in you. Now, while you do your acts in this unity, now notice the in, not doing your acts by yourself, but it's in this unity, okay? They are already incorporated into that single act of the centre. And the divinity is already with you doing what you do. Therefore, this is a divine act. Now you have your definition of the divine act. It's as clear as daylight. Let's read it again. While you do your acts in this unity, that means fused in the divine will and the divine love, these acts are already incorporated into that single act of the centre, which is the centre of God, the centre of heaven. And the divinity is already with you doing what you do. The Celestial Mother, the saints, the angels, and the whole of creation, all in chorus repeat your act. And they also feel the effects of the Supreme Will. Watch. Listen to the prodigy never before seen of that single act which fills heaven and earth with the very Trinity unifying itself with the creature. That is the prodigy of prodigies he's trying to produce in us. And placing itself as the primary act of the creature, therefore these acts are divine. I can't help you with this. You just have to read this so slowly and read it in prayer and ask the Lord to open your mind. So we're going to be talking about our acts are divine. At that moment, Louisa said, I could see the eternal light fixed in me and I could hear the chorus of praise of the whole of heaven and all of creation in its mute language. That's Psalm 19 verses 1 to 6. But who can say everything that I understood of the unity of the light of the Supreme Will? Just that's the expression you're going to hear from now on. Jesus added, my daughter, in order for each act to be good and holy, its origin must come from God. Now that very clearly answers a question that's usually asked in volumes 1 and 2. What is the difference between a human act and a divine act? If it's a divine act, its origin has got to come from God. And behold, for the soul who lives in my will, in the unity of its light, her adoration, her love, her motion, and everything else she may do begins. It has its origin in the divine Trinity, and therefore these are divine acts. Some people call them divine lives. I just like to call them divine acts. So she receives the origin of her acts from God himself. And here is how her adoration, her love, her motion are the same adoration which the three divine persons have among themselves, the same reciprocal love which reigns among the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And her motion is that eternal motion which never ceases and gives motion to all. There you have an explanation of acts in the divine will. Can't be improved on. It's just absolutely perfect. But notice the origin has got to be in God for it to be a divine act. And for our acts to be divine acts, we have to be living in that unity. That means we're living 24/7, 365 in the divine will. We're not doing our own will. We're surrendering the human will all the time. So let's pick up again. The unity of this light places everything in common. You see, the unity of the light is in heaven, making everything in heaven in common. Comes into us, makes everything in common between us and heaven. Whatever God does, the soul does. And whatever the soul does, God does. That's incredible. Now, God won't do anything that isn't divine. So we have to be talking about divine acts if God is doing what we do. God by his own power, notice the word virtue is wrong there. The soul, by virtue of the unity of the light that envelops her, is the correct use of the word virtue. That means by reason of the unity of the light that envelops her. So there's one sentence in which you see the two uses of the word virtue. So God does everything by his own power. Whatever we can do, it's because of our unity in that divine unity of light. Therefore, the prodigy of living in my will is the prodigy of God himself. It's the primary prodigy, while all other prodigies, all other works, good and holy ones, they all remain eclipsed. They disappear before the acts done in the unity of this light. And then he gives an example. Imagine the sun spreading its rays in the unity of life, invading all the earth. And then the creatures, placing before the blazing light of the sun all the lights that exist in the low world, the electric lights and the private lights and all the other lights, as many as they could want to put there, their light would always be nothing before the sun, almost as if they didn't exist. Imagine lighting a candle out in broad sunlight. It'd be a waste of time. And no one would even use any of these lights or give any use to them. They'd all use the sun because the sun is the great light, and all those lights would remain idle. So what he's saying is that as soon as we realize, really realize, the value of a divine act done in God, you won't touch human acts. You wouldn't dream of it. So such are all the other works, he says, which are not done in the unity of my will, the light of my will. So no matter how good the works are, they're just the little lights before the great sun, which one almost does not notice. However, those very lights which are useless and make no impression and do no good when the sun is present, once the sun disappears, they acquire their little value. In other words, you use these little lights in the night when there's no light. And you remember Matthew 5:17, where Jesus said that we have to be a light in the darkness of the world. Okay. And so these little lights in darkness make their own little impression. They do their little good. They are light in the darkness of the night, and they serve the work of man. But they are never sun. They are never at this divine level. So the level of above and the level of below is very, very clearly marked out here. Okay. Nor can they do the great good which the sun can do. Yet the purpose of creation was that all things, having come out from within the unity of the light of the supreme fiat, notice you'll get used to this expression after a while, all would have remained in the unity of it. Now, if we had remained in the unity of it, we'd have paradise on earth. Only the creature didn't want that because she had free will, and she didn't want to recognize this purpose. So notice the she and then the he. He went out of the unity of the light of the sun of my will and reduced himself to begging for the effects of this light, almost as the earth begs its vegetation and its development of its seeds that it hides in its womb from the sun. What sorrow, my daughter, to reduce oneself from being a king to a beggar, and to beg from those which were to be at his service. And we finish on a most wonderful, wonderful, wonderful note of your nothingness. I absolutely love this. It's about as wonderful as you can get on the nothingness. So Jesus was all afflicted and sorrowful from what he has just said, and he kept silent. And Louisa understood all the sorrow that pierced him, because she's in the divine presence, and that's why she understands it. I could feel his sorrow within me penetrating deep into the innermost fibres of my soul. That's because she's in the unity of the light of the divine will. But I wanted to cheer Jesus at any cost, so I returned to my usual acts in the unity of his will, knowing that he easily passes from sorrow to joy when my littleness dives into the inaccessible light of his will. Now, if you're using your own book, would you colour that with green, white and gold? He changes from sorrow to joy when my littleness dives into the inaccessible light of his will. Will you fuse yourself as often as you possibly can, even if it's just a gift of the sheer delight that's been spoken about here? And Jesus loved together with me, and love healed the sorrow. So we need to do many acts of love in the divine will. Then he resumed speaking. My daughter, he said, since I am raising you in my will, oh please, do not want ever to give me this sorrow so piercing of going out of the unity of the light of my supreme fiat. Promise me, swear, that you will always be the newborn of my will. The newborn means that you are completely, totally, absolutely dependent and surrendered to him. So Louisa said, my love, be consoled. I promise, I swear, and you must promise me to keep me always in your arms and sunken in your will. So that will ensure that I can do it. You must never leave me if you want me to be always, always the little daughter of your will, for I tremble and I fear myself. We have a good reason to fear our own weaknesses, more so since the more you speak about this supreme volition, the more I feel that I'm no good. And the nothingness of my nothing makes itself felt more. I love that expression. The nothingness of my nothing. I love that. Because you don't appreciate the nothingness of your nothing unless it has been exposed to you and you are made to rub your nose in your own dung. That's when you begin appreciating the nothingness of your nothing. When people start out, they think they're holy. They think they're going places and they're going to be saints and everything. And when the Lord begins to show you the absolute abject sinfulness of human nature, it's slightly different. And when he makes you see what St. Paul said in Romans 7, I do the things I don't want to do and I don't do the things I want to do. When you really come up against yourself, you come up against the nothingness of my nothing. And he says, that's what you throw into the divine arms. So this is what he says. It's wonderful. Jesus sighing added, my daughter, feeling your nothingness more does not oppose the living in the divine will. On the contrary, it is a duty of yours. Now, have you got a pen? John 3:30. He must increase and I must decrease. 1 Corinthians 1:26 to 31. He only chooses the nothings of this world to confound the strong. 2 Corinthians 12:9. My power is at best in your weakness. But we don't like facing our weaknesses and we don't like facing our nothingness. But it's great liberation when you get there. He said, all of my works are formed out of nothing. That's what you get from Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. Everything is created from nothing. And this is why the all can do what it wants. And he decides that he prefers us to go back into that nothingness where we cannot oppose him, that is the safe place for us to be. So that is the place where we plunge ourselves and we stay there. We stay there. If the sun had risen and someone asked it, what good do you do? What are your effects? How much light and heat do you contain? It would answer, I do nothing. I just know that the light is given to me by God and it is invested with the supreme will and that I do whatever it wants. I extend wherever it wants and I produce the effect it wants. So here you have a very, very good description of the nothing surrendered to the all. And while I do so much, I remain always nothing, and the divine will does everything in me. That's why they're divine acts. It's the same with all my other works. All their glory is to remain in their nothingness in order to give the whole field to my will. That's to give God the freedom to work, to let it operate. How often we heard Jesus saying in the early volumes, will you let me do, stop opposing it. Only man wanted to do without the will of his creator. He wanted to make his nothingness operate, believing himself to be good at something, which of course is pride. And the all, feeling himself placed after the nothing, think of Jesus put after Barabbas. He went out of man. Now that is the real punishment that God can give us. That if the light of the unity of God leaves us, we are left in the darkness of the abyss. And the ultimate final judgment is that the light will abandon those who have been in complete rebellion. So it went out of man, who reduced himself from being the superior of all to the inferior of all. Therefore, he said, let your nothingness be always at the mercy of my will. If you want the unity of its light to operate in you and to call the purpose of creation back to life. Now, I've kept you a long time tonight, but that is pure treasure. And I please ask you to look at it over and over and over and meditate on it.